on both sides. On the one hand, no evidence exists to support the claim that the ODJB initiated the jazz tradition. Indeed, it is even doubtful that the band was the first white group of New Orleans musicians to play jazz. Papa Jack Lane, a turn-of-the-century bandleader, has stronger claims on that distinction. Yet smug dismissals of the ensemble are equally off the mark. LaRocca's cornet playing stands out as especially supple and often inspired, while Larry Shields's clarinet work, although seldom remembered nowadays, also exerted an influence on other musicians at the time. 60 years later, Benny Goodman recalled that Shields had been a strong early influence, along with Jimmy Noon and Leon Ropolo, on his music, adding that he could still play Shields's chorus on St. Louis Blues note for note. True, the group indulged in novelty effects of questionable taste, but so would a host of later jazz musicians, from Jelly Roll Morton to the Art Ensemble of Chicago, without subverting the underlying virtues of their efforts. Although not the best of the early jazz bands, the ODJB was certainly one of the most wide-ranging. Its recordings encompassed jazz, blues, rag forms, and pop songs, as well as arrangements with an additional horn that anticipated the textured voicings of swing music. In their travels, the band members were among the first global ambassadors for hot music. They moved from New York to England, where they gave a private command performance for the royal family, and also journeyed to France, where they helped celebrate the signing of the Treaty of Versailles. The group disbanded in 1925, but rejoined forces briefly in 1936 to record again for the Victor label and go on tour. But this reunion proved short-lived. LaRocca would survive another quarter of a century, and though he no longer performed on the horn, he worked tirelessly as an advocate arguing for the ensemble's historical importance. Inevitably, this zeal in promoting the ODJB as pioneers of the music, no less than the creators of jazz, as their public billings proclaimed, created a fierce backlash within the jazz world, as with their success in securing a recording contract at a time when so many African-American artists were ignored. Yet few bands of that period did more to expose the wider public at home and abroad to the virtues of this new music from New Orleans. The world's greatest hot tune writer. Jelly Roll Morton, the greatest of the New Orleans jazz composers, also generated controversy by his claims to have invented the music. Indeed, Morton was known to exaggerate about many things, so much so that he has acquired the persona of a blustering loudmouth in most historical accounts. However, a careful study of Morton's first-hand recollections, preserved by Alan Lomax in a series of taped interviews and performances for the Library of Congress, reveals that this often maligned figure could be, when the occasion warranted, one of the most thoughtful and accurate sources of information on early jazz. More often than not, later historical research has vindicated Morton's assertions, as well as validated his recreations of earlier musical styles. Moreover, few jazz figures of any era have matched him in providing insightful commentary into the aesthetic dimensions of the music. Although Morton did not invent jazz, he was perhaps the first to think about it in abstract terms, and articulate, in both his remarks and his demonstrations, a coherent theoretical approach to its creation. On a wide range of topics, dynamics, vibrato, melodic construction, the use of breaks, the essence of Latin music, Morton's comments continue to provoke thought and demand our attention. Yet Morton's assertions, for all their musical insight, stand out as paragons of doublespeak and evasion on autobiographical matters. Like his fictional contemporary from the jazz age, F. Scott Fitzgerald's Jay Gatsby, Morton had a flair for rewriting his life story to match the dimensions of his ego. He sometimes gave his birth date as 1885, like many early New Orleans players, adding to his age to strengthen his case of being present at the birth of jazz, and stated that his original name was Ferdinand Lamenth. In fact, Jelly Roll was born in or around New Orleans in 1890 as Ferdinand Joseph Lamoth, and was raised in a strict Creole environment that strenuously resisted assimilation into New Orleans' black population. Morton's family all but disowned him when he became involved in the world of jazz, with its low-life connotations and attendant vices. Not that Morton himself was open-minded in embracing African-American culture. On the contrary, Morton's tendency to rewrite the past was never more apparent than when he dealt with racial issues. In a typically bizarre aside, Morton explained to Lomax that he abandoned the name Lamenth for racial reasons, because of ethnic hostility directed at the French. As to his own African roots, Morton was in a lifelong state of denial, pointing instead to his European ancestry. "All my folks came directly from the shores of France," he told Lomax, "and upper-class Creole background," and putting faith in his relatively light complexion and his mastery of white diction and mannerisms. Even by the standards of Black Creole society of the turn of the century, many of whose members shared his anxieties about assimilation into Black culture, Morton's protestations were extreme. Despite his insatiable ego, Morton would have been nonplussed to see himself lauded by posterity as a major African-American musician. Yet, in his actions, if not his words, Morton strived to relinquish all the highbrow trappings of his Creole youth. More than any other major New Orleans jazz artist, Morton's apprenticeship in the music business took place largely in the bordellos of Storyville, although Morton worked mainly in the white bordellos where few other jazz players could follow. Rather than regretting the lowlife associations of the district, Morton luxuriated in the company of pimps, prostitutes, murderers, gamblers, pool sharks, and dealers and hustlers of various sorts, and at times could rely on a few of these trades himself. At some point in the early 1900s, Morton claimed 1902, although this seems too early given his birth date, he began working as a musician in Storyville. His great-grandmother expelled him from home when she learned of his activities in the district, and before long Morton started on the peripatetic freelancing that would occupy most of his life. His early travels brought him to Memphis, New York, Chicago, St. Louis, Detroit, Tulsa, Houston, and other locales. By 1917, Morton had traveled farther west, visiting California, Canada, Alaska, and Mexico. Wherever Morton journeyed, he was noticed. How could it have been otherwise? He was a big spender, wore a diamond in his tooth and more on his garters, was known to boast that he kept a trunk full of money back in his hotel room, only the top tray carried the cash, but visitors, catching a glimpse, walked away believers, and showed off an extensive and expensive wardrobe, often by changing outfits several times a day. His skills as a pianist and composer were no doubt refined during these years, but Morton's income at this time almost certainly relied more on his activities as a procurer and pool shark. However, when he returned to Chicago around 1923, Morton was well prepared to draw on his considerable talents for self-promotion in building a musical career. Certainly the time was ripe. The jazz age had begun in earnest, and Morton looked to capitalize on the public's insatiable demand for this new style of music. Morton's Chicago years, which lasted until 1926, constitute the most prolific musical period of his career. He made over 100 recordings or piano rolls of his compositions, published a steady stream of pieces, and formed his most famous ensemble, the Red Hot Peppers. This band, which recorded in both Chicago and New York during the remaining years of the decade, achieved a level of collective artistry that few New Orleans groups ever matched, and none surpassed. Nor would Morton's preeminence as a jazz composer, the world's greatest hot tune writer was how his business card modestly described it, be seriously challenged until Duke Ellington pushed the limits of creativity even further in the following decade. But above all, in its mastery of ensemble interaction, so essential to the New Orleans aesthetic, this band remains the paragon to this day. Morton, again like Ellington, was able to get the most out of his musicians, so much so that his groups could rise above the limitations of individual players. Here, Morton's high opinion of his own talents was clearly a decisive factor. By sheer force of will, he prodded his sidemen into sharing his exalted vision of New Orleans jazz. Sometimes Morton used even more dramatic means to keep his musicians on track. A telling anecdote from the 1920s describes a recording session at which trombonist Zoo Robertson refused to play the melody of one of Morton's pieces the way the composer wanted. Morton took a large pistol from his pocket and placed it on top of the piano. On the next take, Robertson played the melody note for note. Morton's 1926 recording of his Sidewalk Blues testifies to the results achieved by this single-mindedness. The piece begins with a roll call, a 10-bar introduction in which each major instrument is summoned to order: piano, trombone, cornet, and clarinet. This leads directly into a 12-bar cornet melody statement over blues harmonies supported by a stop-time vamp. Stop-time techniques such as this, here the band propels the soloist with sharp accents on beats 2 and 4, were a trademark of Morton's music, invariably used for a brief spell to add variety to the accompaniment. A second 12-bar melody follows, this time employing the interlocking trombone-cornet-clarinet counterpoint style, which is the calling card of classic New Orleans jazz. The piece then returns to the opening 12-bar melody, but with a clarinet taking the lead this time. A 4-bar interlude segues into a new 32-bar melody played by cornet, trombone, and clarinet, interrupted briefly at bar 16 by a car horn, a typical Morton novelty twist, that abandons the blues form and sensibility in favor of a plaintive parlor song style. This 32-bar melody is repeated, but now played in an arrangement for 3 clarinets. In the context of the New Orleans style, this was a startling device. Morton brought 2 extra clarinetists to the session, letting them sit idly by most of the day, merely requiring their presence at certain key junctures of the performances, such as this interlude. This change of instrumentation in mid-song, so rare in other jazz recordings of the period, is representative of Morton's penchant to pull out some surprising sound at unexpected places in his music. This understated clarinet section changes direction dramatically in the final 8 bars, with a return of the energetic New Orleans-style counterpoint. A 5-bar tag closes this whirlwind 3.5-minute performance. In a compact form, Morton has covered a world of sounds. When lecturing on Morton's music, I have always been struck by how long it takes to describe in words what is happening in any one of his pieces. For a 3-minute recording, it requires 10 times as much time to provide even a cursory explanation of the various shifts in instrumentation, harmonic structure, and rhythmic support that characterize these performances. This structural complexity is not arbitrary, but essential to Morton's maximalist aesthetic. In his September 1926 version of Black Bottom Stomp, another telling example of this approach, the band disappears midway through the piece, leaving the leader to keep the music flowing with a blistering two-fisted stomp, which Jelly ardently attacks as though it were the star soloist's cadenza in a classical concerto. But in a flash, the Red Hot Peppers are back, this time supporting cornetist George Mitchell in a heated stop-time chorus. This leads directly into a Johnny St. Cyr conversation in syncopated time with the ensemble. Soon, the New Orleans counterpoint of trombone, clarinet, and cornet returns with redoubled energy, the trademark sound, as inevitable as the happily ever after at the close of a fairy tale, that indicates a Red Hot Peppers performance has reached its intended conclusion. Here again, 3 minutes of vinyl are forced to accommodate symphonic aspirations. Morton was not without his limitations. His harmonies, as in Fingerbuster or Froggy Moore, occasionally present clumsy combinations of chromatic and diatonic tendencies, suggesting that the composer was reaching beyond his grasp of theory. His piano playing, for all his assertions to the contrary, was typically less than virtuosic. His claim to have invented jazz hardly merits serious debate. Nonetheless, in terms of overall artistry, Morton's achievements were considerable. These 1926 Victor recordings find Morton at the peak of his creative powers. In performances such as Sidewalk Blues, Black Bottom Stomp, Dead Man Blues, Grandpa's Spells, Smokehouse Blues, and The Chant, he tilled a fertile middle ground between the rigid compositional structures of ragtime and the spontaneous vivacity of jazz improvisation. This style would soon become anachronistic. In fact, it may already have been so by the time these recordings were made, as jazz came to forget its origins in the multi-thematic ragtime form. In this context, Morton's work represents both the highest pitch and final flowering of this approach. Although his artistic vision dominates these sides, Morton benefited from the presence of a seasoned group of New Orleans players. Trombonist Kid Ory, a Creole born in La Place, Louisiana, at some point between 1886 and 1890, had been a successful bandleader in New Orleans before taking his music on the road. In Los Angeles in 1922, his band released the first New Orleans jazz recording featuring black musicians, and in 1925 he moved to Chicago, where he participated in several of the most important studio dates in jazz history, working not only with Morton on the seminal Red Hot Peppers dates, but also recording with Louis Armstrong and King Oliver, among others. His frequent colleague, Johnny St. Cyr, born in New Orleans in 1890, was one of the first jazz string players. St. Cyr was trained as a plasterer, but a musical career beckoned after he taught himself to play a homemade guitar. As a performer with Fate Marable's Riverboat Band, St. Cyr traveled extensively, finally settling in Chicago in the early 1920s, where he also recorded with Armstrong and Oliver. In these years, St. Cyr often played a hybrid instrument, a six-string guitar banjo, which combined the guitar's neck and fingerboard with the banjo's body. Other members of the 1926 Red Hot Peppers included cornetist George Mitchell, clarinetist Omer Simeon, bassist John Lindsay, and drummer Andrew Hilaire. Jelly Roll continued to record frequently during the remainder of the 1920s. The members of his band changed regularly, but regardless of the sidemen or the evolving musical tastes of the American public, Morton's ensembles were at their best when working within the aesthetic constraints of the classic New Orleans idiom. Noteworthy Morton recordings from the 1920s include an invigorating 1927 trio session with clarinetist Johnny Dodds and drummer Baby Dodds, a tantalizing 1924 duet date with King Oliver, and Morton's 1923 work with the New Orleans Rhythm Kings, a historic event that not only produced fine music, but served as a milestone in countering the segregation of black and white jazz players in the recording studio, as well as ongoing performances as a solo pianist. As with so many of the artists from this period, Morton's recording career came to a sudden halt with the Great Depression. But even under happier economic circumstances, his music would almost certainly have fallen out of favor. Jazz had become a soloist's music, and the structured, collectivist aesthetic of Morton's finest work was not in keeping with the prevailing tone of the swing era. Morton had his own somewhat paranoid interpretations of his fall from the limelight after his Victor contract ran out in 1930. At times, he blamed a conspiracy of music industry insiders, led by ASCAP and MCA, for his problems. On other occasions, he asserted that a voodoo curse was the main culprit. In any event, Morton made only one recording during an 8-year stretch during the 1930s. If he maintained any degree of notoriety, it was as the composer of the King Porter Stomp, a piece popularized through the efforts of big band leaders Fletcher Henderson and Benny Goodman, who adapted it to meet the new tastes of the time. In the mid-1930s, Morton settled in Washington, D.C., where he ran an unsuccessful nightclub on U Street. The club changed names every few months in a fruitless attempt to attract a clientele, and continued to hatch schemes for reviving his music career. In 1938, he succeeded in doing just that, spurring his comeback through an audacious move marked by all the trademark Morton excesses. It is evidently known beyond contradiction that New Orleans is the cradle of jazz, and I myself happen to be the creator, opens a celebrated letter Morton sent to Downbeat magazine. The conclusion of this long-winded epistle put everything into perspective, or at least into a Jelly Roll perspective. My contributions were many. First clown director, with witty sayings and flashily dressed, now called master of ceremonies. First glee club and orchestra. The first washboard was recorded by me. Bass fiddle, drums, which was supposed to be impossible to record. I produced the fly swatter. They now call them brushes. Of course, many imitators arose after my being fired or quitting. Lord protect us from more Hitlers and Mussolinis. The letter is signed Jelly Roll Morton, originator of jazz and stomps, Victor artist, world's greatest hot tune writer. Similar letters were sent to other parties, and before long, Morton had established his position as, if not the inventor of jazz, at least its most noteworthy cause célèbre. Further attention came on the heels of the Library of Congress recordings conducted by Alan Lomax. If the Downbeat letter presented Morton as a blusterer, the Lomax interviews offered a more compelling account of his achievements. In his playing, singing, theorizing, and reminiscing on these sessions, Morton left behind one of the most spellbinding documents in the history of jazz music. An era comes to life, revivified under the sure touch of his fingers as they glance over the keyboard, and sketched with oratorical aplomb by Morton's hypnotic voice. Whether as huckster or historian, Morton was a persuasive talker, and record companies were again listening after the long dry spell of the early and mid-1930s. He made the best of these new opportunities, in particular a series of intimate recordings released under the name New Orleans Memories, showcased not only his strengths as a composer, most notably on The Crave and Pianist, but also his less-known skills as a vocalist. His singing here, as well as on the Lomax sessions, is deeply moving and suggests that, under different circumstances, Morton might have made his name in the music world without touching the keyboard. Morton enjoyed his new status as an elder statesman of jazz for only a few short years. Late in 1940, following the death of his godmother, Morton drove across the country in inclement weather with his Lincoln and Cadillac chained together. He was concerned that some diamonds that were in his godmother's possession might be stolen. As events turned out, his fears were confirmed. He stayed on in California, working sporadically as a musician, but soon fell ill. On July 10, 1941, he died in the Los Angeles County General Hospital. The jazz world still has not come to grips with this complicated figure from its earliest days. Morton has served as the inspiration for a novel and has been depicted in a Hollywood movie, excoriated in a Broadway musical, commemorated in modern dance choreography, and psychoanalyzed in liner notes, essays, and articles. Most of these efforts, however, latch on to one side of this variegated personality, usually emphasizing the braggadocio, the gems and flashy wardrobe, or the underworld trappings, painting Morton as some sort of Crescent City Mac the Knife. Too often the music, which is the real diamond in this psychological abyss, gets lost in the process. Even the Broadway musical based on Morton's life and times, Jelly's Last Jam, conveniently relied on other composers for much of its score, almost as if the Morton persona were sufficient, while the artistry could be safely ignored. But in the final analysis, Morton's position in jazz history depends on none of these superfluities, neither the boasting nor the bordello sidelines. Morton's most important legacy lies in his body of compositions, recordings, piano rolls, reminiscences, and lucid commentary on the jazz idiom. It is through these that he earned his place as the most consummate craftsman of the traditional New Orleans style. The New Orleans Diaspora. One of the supreme ironies of the history of New Orleans jazz is that so much of it took place in Chicago. By the early 1920s, the center of the jazz world had clearly shifted northward. New Orleans musicians continued to dominate the idiom, but they were now operating far afield from their native soil. Well before the middle of the decade, a large cadre of major New Orleans jazz musicians were making their reputations in other locales. Jelly Roll Morton left New Orleans around 1908. Freddie Keppard departed in 1914, if not earlier. Sidney Bechet in 1916. Jimmy Noon in 1917. King Oliver in 1918. Kid Ory in 1919. Johnny Dodds around that same time. Baby Dodds in 1921. And Louis Armstrong in 1922. These moves may have begun as brief stints on the road, but in the end proved all but permanent. The vast majority of the New Orleans diaspora never returned to their home state, except for brief visits. This exodus was anything but a purely musical phenomenon. Between the years 1916 and 1919, a 500,000 African Americans left the South for more tolerant communities in the North, with almost 1 million more following in their wake in the 1920s. This vast population shift, which has since come to be known as the Great Migration, encompassed the whole range of black society, from doctors and lawyers to musicians and ministers, from teachers and merchants to artisans and manual laborers. Musicians moved north for the same reasons that motivated other groups, the search for a better life, for greater opportunities to work, to support a family, to enjoy a modicum of personal freedom, options that were much harder for an African American to pursue in the segregated South. As a result, in a host of major cities, Chicago, New York, Cleveland, Detroit, Philadelphia, the black population more than tripled between 1910 and 1930. Certainly there were outstanding musicians who stayed behind in New Orleans, and some even had a chance to record in their native city. Here, for example, the distinguished sides made by Sam Morgan's band in New Orleans during 1927 with their uncanny anticipation of the later four beats to the bar Kansas City swing style. Yet for the most part, ambitious players intent on advancing their careers in jazz during the 1920s had little choice but to look beyond their home turf. In retrospect, we can see that only those who departed made major reputations, both for themselves and for the musical riches of their hometown. In this regard, New Orleans was no different than Memphis, Clarksdale, and other centers of distinctive local and regional performance styles in the South. Nashville has emerged as the only exception, the one city that could build national reputations for its homegrown talent and serve as a destination rather than a starting point for celebrated music careers. New Orleans, for all its fame as a city built on nightlife and entertainment, never achieved that level of self-sufficiency. Bechet, Oliver, Morton, Armstrong, and others were able to put New Orleans jazz on the musical map of American culture, but only by leaving the Big Easy behind. White New Orleans jazz musicians also made the move to Chicago during this period, but in their case, the motivation was not to escape racial intolerance, but to tap the larger economic base of the northern city. As in the case of the ODJB, these white ensembles also found it easier to interest record companies in their music, and for a while enjoyed a virtual monopoly on the jazz record market, at least until the tremendous popularity of the first race records revealed the commercial potential of African-American performers. Within a few months of the initial recordings of black Chicago musicians, racially mixed bands also entered the studio, although the issue of segregation in jazz was anything but resolved by this move, and would continue to be a focal point for conflicts, personal as well as societal, for many years. The collaboration between Jelly Roll Morton and the New Orleans Rhythm Kings, a Chicago-based unit of white Louisiana instrumentalists, was the occasion for this signal event, the first interracial session in the history of Chicago jazz. The Rhythm Kings had already undertaken recording sessions in August 1922 and March 1923 when, in July 1923, they engaged Morton to serve as pianist and composer for a follow-up date. "We did our best to copy the colored music we'd heard at home," group organizer Paul Mares later recalled. "We did the best we could, but naturally we couldn't play real colored style." In Mares's case, his pungent middle-range cornet solos reflect the influence of his contemporary Joe King Oliver, whose band made its first sides in Chicago a few months after the initial Rhythm Kings recordings. Although less rhythmically exciting than King Oliver's Creole jazz band, the New Orleans Rhythm Kings featured strong ensemble work, a sure sense of swing, especially in medium tempos, and the impressive clarinet stylings of Leon Ropolo. Ropolo's work, as demonstrated in his solos on Wolverine Blues and Panama, avoids the arpeggio-based approach that imparted a mechanical quality to so many other first-generation New Orleans clarinetists. Instead, he offers a more linear, melodic style that would come to exert a marked influence on numerous later Chicago school reed players. Yet those seeking the hottest jazz in Chicago circa 1923 inevitably found their way to Lincoln Gardens, the largest dance hall on the South Side, where King Oliver led a band built primarily on the skills of transplanted New Orleans players. Was Oliver the greatest of the early New Orleans cornetists? On this matter, historical accounts are inconclusive. If anything, the deeper one probes, the more one encounters contradictions and unanswered questions. "Most everybody has heard of Joe Oliver and Louis Armstrong," Preston Jackson has asserted, "but few ever heard of Mutt Carey in his prime. Mutt Carey in his day was equal to Joe Oliver." Carey himself had a different story to tell, remarking that Freddie Keppard had New Orleans all sewed up. He was the king. Yes, he wore the crown. Edmund Hall, another of the first-generation players, cast his vote for Buddy Pettit. "Buddy is a man they've never written much about. He kind of what you call set a pace around New Orleans. If Buddy had left New Orleans to go to Chicago when a lot of the other men left, I'm positive he would have had a reputation equal to what the others got." Or what about Emmett Hardy, the white New Orleans cornetist who never recorded and died of tuberculosis in 1925 at the age of 22? "Emmett was the greatest musician I ever heard," later wrote Vic Spiderbeck, who had encountered the New Orleans player when Hardy traveled to Iowa to perform in the early 1920s. Whatever the virtues of these and other neglected figures, Oliver stands out as the New Orleans cornetist who left behind the most impressive body of recordings, recordings that, in many ways, help us understand what the other early figures of New Orleans jazz might have sounded like in their prime. Oliver's band may have lacked the ingenious arrangements of the Red Hot Peppers or the understated elegance of the New Orleans Rhythm Kings, but its hot, dirty, swinging sound comes closest to the essence of the jazz experience. Its appeal draws from its rawness, its earthiness, its insistence. If Jelly Roll's music has aged like a fine wine, Oliver's still cuts to the quick like a jug of bootleg moonshine. Oliver, for his part, was neither the most melodically inventive nor the most technically skilled of the New Orleans cornetists, yet he remains, in many ways, the measuring rod by which we can gauge the work of other New Orleans brass players. His throaty vocal sound inspired many imitators and represented, both conceptually and historically, a meeting ground of earlier and later jazz styles. Hence Oliver's playing carried with it a clear link to a long list of underrecorded or unrecorded early New Orleans cornetists, such as Manuel Perez, Freddie Keppard, Buddy Pettit, and Buddy Bolden. It also looked ahead to the work of later players influenced by Oliver, not only the most famous musical son of New Orleans, Louis Armstrong, but also a host of brass players schooled in the Chicago tradition, as well as the cadre of growling and moaning soloists in various Ellington bands, all of whom are clear descendants of King Joe. In his summation of the past, Oliver could integrate into his playing both a spontaneous Bolden and studied Perez traditions of early New Orleans brass playing. And in his anticipation of the future, we can draw connecting lines all the way to Wynton Marsalis and beyond. By almost any measure, historical, musical, biographical, Joe King Oliver stands out as a seminal figure in the history of the music. We know little about this performer's earliest years, and contradictory sources make even his date of birth a matter for speculation. It may have been as early as 1881, according to his World War I draft registration card, or as late as 1885, based on U.S. Census data. In any event, Oliver came of age in New Orleans during a period in which marching bands played a prominent role in the city's social activities. By his mid-teens, Oliver was playing with these ensembles, and an early apprenticeship with Perez in the Onward Brass Band was perhaps a crucial step in his musical development. Oliver's work retained the influence of these ensembles to the end, as shown by the march-like elements in performances such as High Society and Snake Rag. In 1918, Oliver left New Orleans, and over the next several years he performed not only in Chicago, but as far away as California. In 1921, Oliver returned to Chicago, where his Creole jazz band drew an enthusiastic following among both musicians and the general public during an extended stint at Lincoln Gardens, a dance hall on East 31st Street. For the Lincoln Gardens engagement, Oliver used the same frontline players who had traveled with him to California, Honoré Dutry on trombone and Johnny Dodds on clarinet. But in a surprising move, Oliver now decided to add a second cornet player to the band. This duplication of roles was an oddity at the time, indeed, as it would be in a combo today, but it was an especially peculiar change for Oliver. In California, by contrast, he had relied on violin and saxophone in his attempts to give a richer texture to the group sound. One might think Oliver would follow a similar path in Chicago, or, at a minimum, hesitate to hire another cornetist, if only because of the risk that his own role as star cornetist in the band would be lessened. In fact, something of this sort soon happened. As fate would have it, Oliver's choice for this new spot in the band, Louis Armstrong, an ascending star then still largely unknown outside New Orleans, would come to outshine not only Oliver, but the whole first generation of jazz musicians. Some have stressed Oliver's appreciation of Armstrong's talent as the motivating factor in this move. Others have pointed to Oliver's desire to enhance the musicianship of the Creole jazz band. Perhaps Oliver's sense of his own declining skills as a cornetist, gum problems would eventually force him to abandon the horn, spurred him in this direction. Whatever the reason, Oliver acted quickly. Within a few weeks of securing the Lincoln Gardens gig, in July 1922, he sent a telegram to Louis Armstrong requesting his immediate presence in Chicago. King Oliver and Louis Armstrong. Even within his own lifetime, the mythic elements in Armstrong's biography began crowding out the facts. This conflation of truth and error begins literally with the details of his birth, usually given by Armstrong and many later commentators as the 4th of July in the year 1900. One could hardly imagine a more fitting birthday for a legendary American figure, combining as it does both a symbolic commemoration of national independence and the dawn of the American century. Reality is less elegant. As Tad Jones and Gary Giddens have convincingly proven, the conventional account is exactly 13 months out of sync. The baptismal certificate that Jones uncovered at Sacred Heart of Jesus Church in New Orleans states, in Latin, that Armstrong was born on August 4, 1901, the illegitimate son of William Armstrong and Mary Albert, and was baptized 3 weeks later. Armstrong's own accounts of his parents' role in his upbringing are not consistent, and statements by others are often equally incoherent. For example, Armstrong's parents, according to some versions, were born into slavery, yet records clearly show that the birth dates for both came after the Emancipation Proclamation. All accounts agree, however, in indicating that both William and Mayenne, as Armstrong invariably referred to his mother, were often absentee parents. William was soon living with another woman and eventually devoted his energies to raising a family with his new lover. Mayenne, who appears to have been only 15 years old at the time of Armstrong's birth, left Louis with his grandmother Josephine and moved to Perdido Street, at a time when that area was the center of prostitution in Black Storyville, the implication being that Mayenne earned her livelihood by that means. Armstrong did not return to his mother's care until he was 5. From that time on, he later recalled, a number of different stepfathers shared their living quarters. At the age of 7, Armstrong began working, selling coal to prostitutes in the red light district. The next turning point in Armstrong's biography is also taken on the overtones of popular legend in narrative accounts of his life and times. Shortly after midnight on January 1, 1913, Armstrong was arrested for disturbing the peace. His crime, shooting 6 blanks into the air from his stepfather's .38 revolver. Armstrong was placed in the Colored Waifs Home for Boys, where he remained for 18 months. This punishment may have been a blessing in disguise. The youngster clearly flourished amidst the military discipline of the Waifs Home. Armstrong had already played cornet before this period, again contrary to the usual accounts, as well as performed in a vocal quartet. Nonetheless, the Waifs Home presented a secure, structured environment where music-making in the military tradition was stressed and where recognition for achievement was provided. In this setting, Armstrong steadily moved up the ranks, first playing tambourine, then alto horn, next bugle, and finally cornet. At the time of his release into his father's custody in June 1914, Armstrong was reluctant to leave the Waifs Home, perhaps with good reason. He was soon employed in backbreaking labor, driving a coal wagon, an occupation he pursued until the close of World War I. But as older, more experienced brass players left New Orleans, opportunities for Armstrong to earn money as a musician were on the rise. Over the next several years, his playing graced a number of celebrated bands, including Kid Ory's group, where he replaced Oliver after the latter's departure to Chicago, clarinetist Sam Dutry's Silver Leaf Band, Fate Marable's Riverboat Ensemble, and Papa Celestin's Tuxedo Brass Band. By the time Oliver sent for the young cornetist, Armstrong may have been unknown to jazz fans in Chicago. However, musicians in New Orleans were already taking note of this up-and-coming player. The recordings made by Armstrong's new ensemble, King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, present a number of challenges to the modern-day listener. The most obvious one stems from the poor sound quality of circa 1923 acoustic recordings. This technology, while acceptable in capturing the sound of a single instrument or a human voice, was decidedly weak in presenting the delicate balance between different instruments in a jazz band. And few ensembles were less well suited to this technology than the Creole Jazz Band, with its passionate interplay between contrasting horn lines. But sonic authenticity is perhaps less of a stumbling block to modern ears than is the very unmodern aesthetic vision underpinning early New Orleans jazz music. Unlike later jazz, with its democratic reliance on individual solos, the New Orleans pioneers created a music in which the group was primary, in which each instrument was expected to play a specific role, not assert its independence. The most characteristic moment in these recordings of early jazz takes place when the lead instruments, usually cornet, clarinet, and trombone, engage in spontaneous counterpoint. The trombone takes over the low register, providing a deep, deliberate bass melody. The clarinet plays more complex figures, often consisting of arpeggios or other rapidly fingered patterns in a higher register. The cornet moves mostly within the middle register, playing less elaborate melodies than the clarinet, but pushing the ensemble forward with propulsive, swinging lead lines. No early jazz band was better at this ensemble style of playing than Oliver's Creole Jazz Band. Oliver's melodic vocabulary was primitive, almost simple-minded by modern standards. His famous solo on Dipper Mouth Blues builds off a few notes, a concise melodic fragment played over and over with minor variations. Here, as elsewhere, the virtue of Oliver's playing lies not in linear improvisation, but in his seamless blending with the band and, especially, in the haunting vocal quality of his cornet work. King Oliver left behind no interviews with jazz historians, and we can only speculate about the specifics of his artistic vision. However, one comment that has come down to us is especially revealing. Oliver claimed to have spent 10 years refining his cornet tone. This obsession with sound gets to the heart of the New Orleans Revolution in music, and to the essence of Oliver's contribution to it. Instead of aspiring to classical purity of tone, emulating an otherworldly perfection, the early jazz players strive to make their instruments sound like human voices, with all the variations, imperfections, and colorations that such a model entailed. This was an approach to music that defied conventional notation and refused to be reduced to a systematic methodology. Richard Hadlock, recalling a music lesson given to him by Sidney Bechet, conveys something of this fastidious New Orleans attention to tone production. "I'm going to give you one note today," he once told me. "See how many ways you can play that note. Growl it, smear it, flat it, sharp it, do anything you want to it. That's how you express your feelings in this music. It's like talking." This admonition, "growl it, smear it, flat it, sharp it, do anything you want to it," could very well be a description of the rugged beauty of Oliver's playing. His music is not about scales or passing chords. It is a celebration of color and texture. From this perspective, King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band provided an odd context for Armstrong to hone his skills as a jazz musician. Herein lies the oddity. Armstrong would soon emerge as the first great soloist in the history of jazz, yet he refined his talents in an ensemble that featured few solos. Oliver conceived of jazz as collective music making in which the instruments were interdependent and no one horn was allowed to dominate. Armstrong in particular was especially constrained. As second cornetist, he was expected to add a supporting line or harmonic fill under Oliver's lead line, and the recordings of the band show that, when so inclined, he was capable of doing this with great skill. Nonetheless, Armstrong's more powerful tone and greater technical facility made him a poor choice for such a subservient role. At times, as on the OK recordings of Mabel's Dream or in his quasi-solo on Froggy Moore, the second cornetist clearly overpowers the bandleader. In New Orleans jazz, the equivalent of the chief steward's mutiny. On the rare occasions when he was allowed to stand out from the rest of the group on Chimes Blues and Tears, Armstrong presents poised and fluid lines that contrast markedly with the rest of the band. Even at this early stage, Armstrong was a player of consequence, demonstrating his ability to hear and adapt to the musical flow around him, as well as a rhythmic sensibility that was paradoxically both relaxed and propulsive. On the other hand, Armstrong would never match Oliver's mastery of the mute, or be able to evoke the wide range of growls and moans the latter could elicit from his horn. His wife and colleague in Oliver's band, Lil Hardin, would later recall how Armstrong spent days trying to imitate his boss's famous solo on Dippermouth Blues, a solo that, despite its melodic simplicity, he could never quite recreate. "I think it kind of discouraged him," she noted, "because Joe was his idol and he wanted to play like Joe." The sensation of listening to these performances is both exhilarating and disturbing. Armstrong's musicianship was far beyond that of his colleagues, hence the exhilaration. It contrasts in the sharpest degree with Hardin's penchant for muddling the chord changes, trombonist Honoré Dutrey's often uninspired melody lines, and Dodds's hesitant approach to his parts. Compare the King Oliver sides to Dodds's carefree and superior work with Jelly Roll Morton, or his fine performances with the New Orleans Wanderers. Armstrong's mastery can only stand out impressively in such a setting. Yet, at the same time, his individualistic approach also comes across as disturbingly subversive. Is it not a deliberate undermining of a collective aesthetic? In the context of his later recordings, with their emphasis on solo playing, his charismatic and heroic stance is an asset. But in the setting of the Creole Jazz Band, it disrupts the seamless blending of instrumental voices that is the crowning glory of the early New Orleans style. Here we encounter one of the grand ironies of jazz history, and a telling reminder of the rapid pace of change in the music's development. Namely that, because of Armstrong's presence, the King Oliver recordings from the early 1920s stand out both as a paramount example of the New Orleans collective style, and also anticipate its obsolescence, already hinting at the more individualistic ethos that would replace it. The passing of the baton from Oliver to Armstrong also marks another decisive turning point in the history of American music. Oliver represents a more Africanized sensibility, in which musicians work with sound textures rather than pure and discrete notes. The idea of codified musical structures built on notes and scales is a distinctly Western idea, our legacy from Pythagoras and the Greeks, and quite alien to the traditions of Africa. For Western music to assimilate the jazz sensibility, it required an innovator like Louis Armstrong, a visionary who was more than just a sound painter, but a true master of licks and phrases and all the complicated combinations of notes that appeal to the Western musical mind. We see the same transition in the blues when we move from the oral ambiguities of Son House to the precise constructions of Robert Johnson. This adaptation is never pure or complete. What an Armstrong or Johnson plays is never just notes. Even so, an important divide has been crossed, and the African heritage has now been schematicized in a new manner, transformed through the impact of these masters in a way that allows the alien style to seep into the inner life of American, and eventually global, music. By mid-1924, the core of Oliver's band had left, primarily because of the sidemen's suspicion that their leader was withholding money due them. By the time Oliver recorded again with a new group named the Dixie Syncopators, the jazz world had changed as a result of the growing popularity of the big band format. Oliver attempted to adjust his music to this emerging sensibility with the addition of two or three saxophones and the adoption of more tightly arranged pieces. This later phase in Oliver's career is often dismissed by critics for its abandonment of the more spontaneous New Orleans interplay between the horns. Nonetheless, Oliver might have successfully weathered the transition to the big band era with this new approach had not his playing begun to deteriorate in the face of continual embouchure problems. The extent of these and their chronology are a matter of debate, but the broad general trend is unmistakable. As time went on, Oliver played less frequently, and the quality of his work was inconsistent at best. By the mid-1930s, he could no longer play at all. Various letters written by the cornetist toward the end of his life and later published have been rightly called by jazz critic Martin Williams among the most moving documents which have been preserved from the past in jazz. These, combined with anecdotal accounts of Oliver's later days, serve as a disturbing reminder of not only Oliver's plight, but also the degraded conditions of life for Southern blacks during the Great Depression. Having outlived his fame, Oliver worked long hours in menial jobs, poolroom janitor, roadside vendor, and the like, struggling without success to raise enough money to purchase a railroad ticket to join his sister in New York. At his death in April 1938, he was living in near poverty in Savannah, Georgia. His return to New York was posthumous. Oliver's sister used her rent money to bring the cornetist's body to New York, where he was buried at Woodlawn Cemetery in an unmarked grave, since no funds were left to provide a headstone. A memorial was later put in place courtesy of the New Jersey Jazz Society. Louis Armstrong, Clarence Williams, and a few other musicians were in attendance. By the late 1930s, Oliver's music may have been all but forgotten among the general public, but through his protege, Louis Armstrong, Oliver would leave a lasting mark on both the jazz idiom and the broader streams of popular culture. By this time, Armstrong's influence was pervasive in the jazz world. But even more remarkable was Armstrong's ability, then becoming increasingly evident, to extend his fame beyond the confines of jazz, to develop an international renown and status, with his visage and demeanor instantly recognizable even to those who paid little attention to jazz music. In this regard, Armstrong ranks with only a handful of figures from the first half of the 20th century. Charlie Chaplin, Pablo Picasso, Babe Ruth, Al Jolson, Shirley Temple, Winston Churchill, whose fame transcends the realities of time and place and blends into a mythic larger-than-life presence, one in which the border between image and actuality blurs. Armstrong's status as cultural icon, however, is perhaps a mixed blessing for the student of jazz history. With such celebrities, the image threatens to overshadow the essence, or even to become the essence. To understand Armstrong's role as jazz innovator and not just as a mass-market entertainer requires us to look past the superficial trappings of his fame and instead probe deeply into the body of work he left behind. It is here that we will uncover the vital core of Armstrong's achievement as a jazz musician. Chapter 3. The Jazz Age. The Age of the Soloist. Revolutions, whether in arts or matters of state, create a new world only by sacrificing the old. With jazz, it is no different. To be sure, Louis Armstrong, who closed the book on the dynastic tradition in New Orleans jazz, putting an end to its colorful lineage of Kings Bolden, Keppard, and Oliver, stands out as an unlikely regicide. Armstrong always spoke with deference, bordering on awe of his musical roots, and with a special devotion of his mentor, Joe Oliver. Yet the evidence of the grooves does not lie. The superiority of Armstrong's musicianship the unsurpassed linear momentum of his improvised lines could serve only to make Oliver, Morton, and Bolden, and the whole New Orleans ensemble tradition look passé, a horse and buggy cantering by Henry Ford's assembly line. The New Orleans pioneers exit stage left. Armstrong, on trumpet, enters stage right, heralding the new age of the soloist. Or so it seems in retrospect. But the ebb and flow of any history seldom match the rigid categories and sharp delineations we apply after the fact. In actuality, the revolution initiated by Armstrong took place in fits and starts, and with little fanfare at the time. After Armstrong's departure from King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band, over a year would pass before he would record as a leader. And even when those famous recordings were planned, the classic Hot Fives, the record company considered enlisting a better-known leader to front the band. Most accounts stress that Armstrong's talents may have been neglected by the general public, but were amply recognized by the musical community. His playing was revered by countless jazz musicians, runs a typical commentary. But even this claim is suspect. Fletcher Henderson, Armstrong's first major employer after Oliver, made the trumpeter accept a cut in pay to join his band. Many accounts suggest that Henderson, in fact, preferred the playing of cornetist Joe Smith, and that Armstrong was hired only because Smith was unavailable. Could this be true? The recorded evidence bears out the claim. When Smith joined the Henderson band in the spring of 1925, an increasing number of solos went to him, not Armstrong. Smith, to his credit, performed admirably. Though he lacked Armstrong's rhythmic drive, his warm sound and ease of execution could hardly be faulted, and may have been better received by the average dancehall patron, circa 1925. Henderson was even less enthusiastic about Armstrong's singing, an attitude that greatly frustrated the new band member. Years later, he would exclaim, "Fletcher didn't dig me like Joe Oliver. He had $1 million talent in his band, and he never thought to let me sing." Armstrong may not have taken New York or even the Henderson band by storm, but slowly and steadily he exerted his influence on the musical community. Brass players were the first to feel the heat of Armstrong's rising star, but, as with Charlie Parker's innovations 20 years later, Armstrong's contributions eventually spread to every instrument in the band. Don Redman's arrangements, Coleman Hawkins's saxophone work, one by one, the converts were won. Armstrong the sideman? Not really. Armstrong was a leader, if only by example, during his time with the Henderson band. In an 8-bar passage from his solo on Shanghai Shuffle, he offers a telling lesson in rhythmic ingenuity. Here, Armstrong stokes the fire merely by repeating, with variations in length, placement, and intensity, a single note. What would have been monotonous in the hands of any other band member comes to life under the sway of Armstrong's sure mastery of syncopation. On Shanghai Shuffle and many of his other features with the Henderson Band, Copenhagen from October 1924, Mandy Make Up Your Mind from early December, I'll See You in My Dreams recorded a month later, Armstrong was pointing the way to a more modern conception of improvisation. In the end, his impact was decisive for the Henderson Band, for the New York scene, for the jazz world. Armstrong's stiffest challenge during these months leading up to the Hot Five recordings came in a different setting. As a sideman in the Clarence Williams Blue Five, Armstrong faced off with Sidney Bechet, the only man who, in the words of critic Gary Giddens, for a short while seemed Armstrong's equal as an improviser during those transitional years. Bechet, born May 14, 1897 in New Orleans, may have been only 4 years older than Armstrong, but he already had accumulated a world of experience since first leaving New Orleans in his late teens. In 1919, he had traveled to Europe with Will Marion Cook's Southern Syncopated Orchestra, where he dazzled audiences and won the praise of noted Swiss conductor Ernest Ansermet. In a prescient piece published in Revue Romande in 1919, Ansermet declared Bechet to be an artist of genius and suggested that his clarinet playing was perhaps the highway the whole world will swing along tomorrow. Other memorable performances by this early ambassador for hot music included a garden party at Buckingham Palace for the Prince of Wales, the future King Edward VIII, and an armistice ball at the Royal Albert Hall. Bechet returned to the United States with an enhanced reputation, but also, and perhaps more importantly, with a soprano saxophone, which he had spotted in a shop window during a stroll through London's West End. Up until this point, Bechet's work had been restricted to clarinet, an instrument he had learned under the influence of three New Orleans pioneers of the instrument, George Bequet, Big Eye Louis Nelson, and Lorenzo Tio. The tradition Bechet inherited from these musicians was anything but primitive. Indeed, the clarinet was, in certain respects, the most advanced of the jazz instruments during these early years. Clarinetists in the New Orleans tradition worked assiduously to develop great finger flexibility and, as a result, were often assigned the most intricate parts in performance. This fluid approach to the clarinet grew out of a tradition of melodic embellishment, rather than the freer, linear development we associate with later jazz horn players, as demonstrated by the well-known obbligato section in the piece High Society, which served as a technical showpiece for many New Orleans clarinetists. Melodic complexity, however, was far from the only distinguishing characteristic of the New Orleans clarinet sound. Figured patterns built from arpeggiated chords were often employed as the building blocks for New Orleans clarinet solos. Because of this, these players needed to have a reasonably sophisticated understanding of chord structures. Years later, Coleman Hawkins would develop this penchant into a probing, harmonically adept saxophone style. But even with the first generation of jazz reed players, the chordal implications of their playing were prominent. Yet the clarinet tradition that Bechet inherited was not without its limitations. The figured patterns that served as the foundation for many early clarinet solos soon came to represent a stylistic dead end. Caught up in the static vocabulary, these first-generation players tended to leave the rhythmic potential of their instrument largely untapped. Syncopations played a modest role in their efforts and, when employed, rarely moved beyond restatements of the rhythmic patterns developed years before in the ragtime idiom. And even at its dirtiest, the New Orleans clarinet rarely approached the rawness of the more unbridled cornet improvisations. In this environment, it was mostly left to the brass players, Bolden, Keppard, Oliver, Armstrong, to expand the rhythmic vocabulary and explore the variations of tone possible within the context of the New Orleans style. Bechet played the most prominent role in developing the clarinet as a mature solo voice in jazz. Other performers no doubt also contributed. Here, for instance, Leon Ropolo's underappreciated recordings with the New Orleans Rhythm Kings that gave notice of the instrument's potential as early as 1922. Yet Bechet's role was especially influential in pointing the way toward a more melodic, linear conception of the horn and drawing on a more expansive palette of sounds. Much like King Oliver, Bechet developed a voice-like quality to his playing and exhibited a rare sensitivity to the potential of timbre and phrasing. These skills allowed him to stand out as a premier soloist, yet, unlike Armstrong, Bechet felt equally at home submerging his melody lines in the larger ensemble. This difference in temperament between the two great New Orleans players is evident in their December 1924 pairing on Early Every Morn, where they ostensibly support vocalist Alberta Hunter. Bechet's soprano work, with its mixture of high-held notes and diving phrases into the lower register, blends well with the group and provides ample space for Armstrong's countermelodies. Armstrong, in contrast, assumes a more assertive posture and belts out a flamboyant coda to the performance, one that tends to eclipse Hunter and the rest of the band. Such exhibitions of technique were not Bechet's forte. Yet he, too, could indulge in grandstanding when the situation so warranted. On another collaboration from the period, Texas Moner Blues, Armstrong again takes center stage with a brief burst of double time in his feature break. But Bechet is not to be outdone in this encounter. He lets loose a swarming cannonade of angular phrases, less fluid than the cornetists, but clearly signaling a determination to match any contender note for note, even the great Louis Armstrong. And this time Bechet steals the show with a bluesy coda. Bechet flirted with big band music and even served a brief stint with the Ellington Orchestra, but for the most part, he retained his predilection for the New Orleans ensemble style. In the early 1930s, when Armstrong adapted his music to the public's newfound preference for big bands, Bechet kept true to the earlier approach, most notably in his recordings with trumpeter Tommy Ladnier. Their work on I Found a New Baby and Maple Leaf Rag from 1932 demonstrated, to those willing to listen, that the old style had not lost its charm. Audiences, however, were largely unimpressed. The New Orleans revival was still almost a decade away. After an unsuccessful stint at the Savoy Ballroom, Bechet and Ladnier temporarily left the music business, setting up a tailor shop in Harlem, where the trumpeter shined shoes while Bechet focused mostly on pressing and repairs, when he wasn't busy in the back room cooking Creole food or hosting a jam session. Bechet was eventually enticed back into performing by an offer from bandleader Noble Sissle.